Some Iowans are working to save their treasured belongings from floodwater, and some of us are just working against time. Today, we'll focus on preserving artifacts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Time takes a toll on everything: buildings, books, photos, and other mementos of the past. This hour, we'll talk about preserving our history by saving our stuff. I'll talk with experts about taking care of our personal treasures, as well as those that teach us about our communities and our state. We'll find out how to manage mini disasters and save precious photographs, books, and scrapbooks from a flood. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. People who work in museums, archives, libraries, and historic buildings are always battling against the toll that time and circumstance can take on historic artifacts. Many of us also fight that battle in a small way with the precious treasures we keep in our homes. On Friday, experts from around the state will meet in Mason City at Save Our Stuff 2013, put on by the Iowa Conservation and Preservation Consortium, the Knighter Art Museum, and the Mason City Public Library. A few of those experts have agreed to join us today to share their knowledge. And I want to introduce first Nancy Kraft, who is head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And can you give us a little bit of background about this Iowa Conservation and Preservation Consortium?
Well, I'm trying to remember when it started. I think right after 1993 floods. A group of us librarians, museum and archivists wanted to have a way that we could get together. And also the we call ICPC, the Iowa Conservation Preservation Consortium. Our mission, our goal is to provide training and education around the state for those who care for collections, whether it's your own personal items or something that you're responsible for on day-to-day.
So the 1993 floods may have served as a fairly major wake-up call around the state.
It was, a major wake-up call.
And, of course, we've had some floodwater since then as well. I want to introduce our other experts today as well. Christina Castell is Curator of History and Anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Grace Linden is with us on the phone today. She is Curator of History at the Sioux City Public Museum. Hello, Grace. Oh, no, I'm sorry. She's not with us yet. Okay. And Melissa Tadone is a conservator at Iowa State University's library. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here as well. And I want to start the hour by talking about flooding, because obviously that's something that's been on a lot of people's minds. And this flood is turning out for most places to not be as significant as 1993. Not as significant as 2008, although there are some towns in Iowa that have been hit harder than they were in those years. But it is a time when a lot of us think about what would happen if my house got flooded. What would I lose? And Nancy, before we talk about taking care of the stuff that has been hit by a flood, tell me what we should do if we're worried that we may get flooded to protect our stuff.
Well, what I tell people is, especially if you're in your homes, it's a good time now to take a walk around the outside of your house. Make sure your downspouts aren't plugged up. You want that water going as far away from your house as possible. Make sure sometimes dirt, sod, sinks towards your house and offers a fantastic opportunity to bring things into your house. The other thing is, if you have a basement, take a walk in your basement and make sure not any of your precious materials have ended up on the floor. That happened to me in 93. I was moving and set something on the floor and forgot about it. So those are some real good preventative things. And in case you'd have to suddenly evacuate, you want to have those phone numbers not just in your phone, but in your purse, in your medications, Doesn't sound like we're going to get to that point, but those are just a few little things that you should keep in mind.
So do you have a recommendation for people about where to keep, say, photographs, books, that kind of thing? Do you suggest just keeping it out of the basement altogether if you possibly can?
Well, if you can, but if people are like me, you can't. You just have so much space. So your more precious stuff, if the higher off the floor, I mean, I've got things in boxes and in cabinets that are probably five feet above the basement. And then some of, like, my parents' letters and things like that I have upstairs. It's good to have it in a room that's pretty well ventilated and temperature and humidity is fairly stable. Keep them away. For book collections, we almost always end up shelving them along the wall. So having 2-3 inches space, don't shove them up against the wall because they can act like a sponge and pull water out. The thing that happened most often in 93 was it didn't get very warm, so people didn't use their air conditioners, which tends to help dry things out. So I got a lot of phone calls in August about mold, especially on artworks. So check your artwork. Make sure you have those little bumpers that you can put in the back so there's a little air going through.
Well, and even if we don't get as much flood water this year, there are many things about the weather that are reminiscent of 1993. We haven't had the summer heat yet, so that could be an issue for people this year with humidity in their homes.
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons. It does remind me more of 93, and we're all, you know, we like to save money, so this is a good time not to turn on the air conditioning, but I've run mine a couple times already because my house started smelling musty.
And Christina, I know that you're focusing your talk at the Save Our Stuff 2013 conference on mini disasters. And of course, major flooding events are not the only thing that can happen, but water getting on our stuff tends to be one of the big problems, even if it's just a burst pipe in our own home or a basement flooding because there's been a heavy rainfall. When that happens, do we need to take stock of what kind of water maybe entering our home and getting on our things?
I think absolutely that's a health issue for yourself as well as for your objects, is that you need to, if it's a sewage line break or a sewage line backup, you're going to be treating that differently than you would a water pipe that's broken in your house that's clean water. Obviously, you're going to be using protective gear, making sure that you're not handling anything with bare skin to protect your own health.
I would guess that a sewage line would be the very worst kind of water that would enter your home.
I can't imagine anything worse. But still, a conservator can help clean up after that. If you have a treasure, for example, a wedding dress that has been in sewage water, you'd want to make sure that you don't throw it out. Because it can be saved. There's a lot of ways that you can save something like that. Even just getting it into fresh, pure water, freezing it, and then getting it up to conservation would save this treasured item that you would maybe want to pass on to all your heirs.
So when you're taking stock of a disaster like that, do you need to make a priority list? Okay, the wedding dress is the most important thing. How do you categorize things?
You do have to. Well, first of all, historic preservation is expensive. And so for your general preserving your photos, letters, and documents and objects, you still would want to have a priority ahead of time anyway. Most of us don't do that until we have a disaster. But the ideal situation is to have a priority list of what your family wants. You know, the wedding dress, the photos, the family china, silver, whatever. And those are the things that you spend money on preserving now. And when a disaster happens, that's where you would want to have those objects close together so you can grab them and get them out if it's a fire or something like that. And again, of course, with a fire, don't risk your life. Don't risk your life grabbing treasures because a lot of things can be preserved. But if it's all together or if you know where the one or two items that you must have are, then you can grab them in case of a tornado, take them downstairs, whatever. So,
do you recommend that people look into fireproof boxes, that kind of thing, so that they're a little bit disaster proof?
I do, absolutely. Fireproof boxes can be amazing in saving letters. Of course, if the heat gets too hot, it can still get crispy. The paper can get crispy, but it won't burn up. So it's by far an advantage to go ahead and invest a small amount of money in a fireproof.
And you mentioned freezing a wedding dress. Is cold a real ally in dealing with a flood or a disaster like that?
It is, because of course you've got mold and mildew issues, as Nancy was talking about. And so if you can get something into the freezer, you're preventing that mold and mildew from starting at that point. And then you can take your time and figure out what you're going to do with it. So it gives you the luxury of time, which most of us don't have in disasters. So.
Right. Well, and Melissa, I know that you're going to be focusing your talk on historic scrapbooks, and we're going to talk a lot about these scrapbooks in just a few minutes, but that seems like an item that would be particularly vulnerable in a disaster.
Historic scrapbooks would absolutely be vulnerable, and part of that is because they can contain so many different types of material. And then that can also make it complicated when you're trying to save them once they've got wet, for example. It's a great idea to freeze paper-based items and other fiber-based items like the wedding dress mentioned earlier, but you don't really want to freeze photographs. It's not such a good idea for those. And then there are other materials like fragile botanical samples that might not do as well being frozen. So I really advocate that people take preventative measures with an item like a scrapbook and really save themselves the hassle of trying to respond later and save the item once it has been severely damaged.
Well, we will talk a lot more. We're going to take a break here in just a moment. We'll talk a lot more about scrapbooks because I know that's something that a lot of people have on their shelves or in boxes that they would love to preserve, but they can be tricky. And, you know, Nancy, in talking about saving our stuff, we have this comment on our Facebook post from Tony, who says, as long as my family is safe, stuff is just stuff and can be replaced or done without. And of course, that's true. But a lot can be lost in a disaster like a flood. Why is this stuff important?
Well, sometimes for me, that's a connection to my family. And if I lose the photographs that, bring back treasured memories, and I think every individual's different. Some people don't care. And in others, this is something that we get fond memories and it's nice to touch and feel and see.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking about historic preservation this hour with Nancy Kraft, head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries, Christina Castell, curator of history and anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport, and Melissa Tadone, conservator at Iowa State University Library. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about historic preservation. Coming up Friday, experts from around the state will meet in Mason City at Save Our Stuff 2013, which is put on by the Iowa Conservation and Preservation Consortium, the McNider Art Museum, and the Mason City Public Library. We have a few of those experts with us today. Nancy Kraft is head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries. Christina Castell is curator of history and anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport, and Melissa Tadone is conservator at Iowa State University's library. And I promised before the break that we were going to focus a little bit on those historic scrapbooks, Melissa, that you work with so much. And we also want to invite your calls. If you have an item that you are worried about preserving, you'd like some advice from our experts here today, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Melissa, what makes scrapbooks so difficult to preserve?
Well, scrapbooks are what we call composite artifacts, meaning that they're made up by a lot of different stuff. And a book itself is a composite item. It could have leather, cloth, adhesive sewing thread paper, which is already pretty complex. But then with scrapbooks, people are adhering ephemera, like cards or photographs or candy. I've seen a scrapbook with a piece of wedding cake in it, believe it or not.
No.
botanical samples, newspaper clippings, you name it. Someone has put it in a scrapbook somewhere.
Well, and I admire people who scrapbook so much. And when I see a historic scrapbook, I think, oh, I wish I'd saved so much of my stuff over the years in that way. And I haven't. But you're creating something that really could deteriorate quickly.
It's very true. Each item in a scrapbook has its own what we call inherent vice, sort of the seeds of its own destruction. So if it's newsprint paper, for example, that tends to contain lignins, which release acids, and acids can cause the paper fibers to break down. And if you can imagine, each item in a scrapbook is going through its own deterioration process on its own, but then whatever it's leaching out, whether it's off-gassing chlorine or creating acids, those materials are going to be affecting the other materials in the scrapbook. And so it can really accelerate the deterioration.
When did we start to understand the need for acid-free paper?
I would say that really started in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. As modern conservation got going, and we started realizing that the old paper that was handmade and produced before about the 1860s is actually still in wonderful condition. It's supple, it has a nice drape, it's not brittle. And then in the 1860s, as the sort of mass-produced manufacturing of paper came into full force, people started using wood pulp. And it really took until about the 1950s, 60s for people to realize that what wood pulp contains actually can contribute to a rapid deterioration of the paper itself.
So when did the general public embrace acid-free paper? I mean, if there are scrapbooks in my home that date back before a certain date, or are there books that I need to be more concerned about than others?
Absolutely. Really anything from 1980 forward, I would say, you probably don't need to worry about. That's when publishers really got on board with this idea of acid-free paper and forced the paper industry to start producing acid-free paper. I would like to clarify the term acid-free, however.
Okay.
Products are allowed to be labeled acid-free as long as they are acid-free at the time that they leave the manufacturer. So they don't necessarily stay acid-free depending on what they've been made with. So if people are creating new scrapbooks, then they really want to look not just for the term acid-free, but also the term lignin-free. Lignin is a material in wood pulp, which can, as it breaks down, start to accelerate those acid deterioration products. So if something is lignin-free, it's going to have much greater longevity than just being acid-free.
And is that commonly labeled on scrapbooking material?
It is actually becoming very common to find that term.
All right. So if you're spending all the time to put something together, that seems like an important decision to make. But you're telling me that if any scrapbooks in your home are over 30 years old, they really could be at risk.
Absolutely.
So if you have a scrapbook that is over 30 years old, what do you need to do?
Well, first you need to have a look at it and look for signs that something might be going wrong. Are you seeing darkening, yellowing, browning around the edges, where light filters into the edges of the scrapbook? Are you seeing a brittleness in the paper, or a darkening or brittleness in any of the items that are adhered? If you have one of those prefab magnetic photo albums, they were called, where there's like a sheet of plastic that you lift up and then there's the sticky stuff. Those were so popular for a while. And if you have one of those, that is the only case where I across the board recommend that you remove your items and just put them in an entirely new storage structure if you can. Because that plastic film is made of PVC, so it's off-gassing chlorine. And the type of adhesive that was used is really, really has a tendency to migrate into your photographs and clippings and whatever else you have in there.
Well, you just gave a lot of us a very long homework assignment. I know I have several of those from my childhood on the shelf right now.
Oh, I know. I once spent an entire vacation at home visiting my parents, going through all of the photo albums from my childhood, removing photographs from those magnetic photo albums.
When you take out the photographs, do you have to do anything special with them, or just put them somewhere else, put them in another kind of book?
Yeah, usually not. Store them in acid-free envelopes. They make great storage boxes now for photographs, or, you know, even put them in another type of album that's made of more conservationally sound materials.
Now, I have done a lot of digitizing of my family's pictures. I have a lot more to do. Is that something you recommend for people?
I do. You know, preserving digitized materials comes with its own set of preservation challenges, but as the technology is getting better, I think it's a great way to have a backup, a secondary copy. I wouldn't digitize my photographs and then throw the originals away. I would still keep those, of course. But it's such a great idea to digitize them, because then you can print surrogates and frame those and display them. And you're not worried about the original being damaged by light exposure, or, you know, you can keep the originals in a more stable environment and then do whatever you want with the copies.
We're talking about historic preservation this hour in a number of different ways. We have a number of experts with us. I'm talking with Melissa Tidone, a conservator at Iowa State University's library, and we're focusing on historic scrapbooks. We also have Christina Castell, who's curator of history and anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport, and focusing today on many disasters and trying to mitigate the problems that can be caused by that, whether you're at home or at a museum or a library. Nancy Kraft is also with us. She's the head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. I know a lot of us have historic items that we would like to preserve and take care of. And you are welcome to call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have an email from Jackie, who says, I have an old beaded prayer and the backing is pierced paper. Because paper and backing were not acid free, the paper has darkened and is deteriorating. I'm afraid to even move it in its current frame because it looks so fragile. Is it too late to preserve it? And who would I contact to preserve such an item? It's at least 50 plus years old and has just been in a home atmosphere all this time. And Melissa, is that something you could respond to?
Could you tell me what a beaded prayer is?
I don't know. Do you? Jackie, send us some more information. Again, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Nancy or Christine, do you have any? Do you know?
I'm assuming that it's a prayer written out on paper, maybe that's got beads on it. So this would be one of those multiple material type objects.
I always recommend that people get in touch with a professional before they give up on an item, because, and I'm sure Nancy can speak to this as well, after a disaster, I think people often make an assumption that, oh, this got totally saturated, or it's got a little mold on it, I'm just going to throw it away because it's beyond help. You would be amazed, you know, what we can salvage as long as you do contact a professional in time. So
Christina,
please do talk to someone before
you
make that assumption.
Christina, you want to add something to that?
I do. And this is not in regards to water, but as Melissa was saying,
I had somebody bring in a wedding dress once to me, or rather part of a wedding dress that had been through a fire, partially burned and partially intact. It was her grandmother's wedding dress. And she wanted to know what to do with it. Can I save it? What can I do? And so we talked about their life experience as a family and determined that this object was reflective of their family, the phoenix out of the ashes. And so I said, be proud of this piece. You know, let's vacuum the ashes out of it, get it cleaned up enough, and mount it in a shadow box and have it in your house so that you can point it out to your guests who come in and say, this is our family treasure. It was saved from a fire, and we're rebuilding from our ashes too.
Wow. Neat. Nancy?
Yes, we do the same thing, talk to people about let the artifact tell its story. So that it's got layers, as Christine said.
And when we talk about contacting a professional, how do we find a professional who can help us with this? I mean, you're all attached to certain institutions. So are there historic preservationists who freelance?
We have a list, and through ICPC, we're very networked. So if they contacted any one of us, my phone number is 319-335-5286. If anyone contacts, then, like I said, any one of us will network and make sure that the person gets to the right expert. We do have people here in Iowa, and then sometimes we need to send people out of state. But we can get people connected.
Also, the American Institution for Conservation of Artistic and Historic Works has a website, and they have a button you can click called Find a Conservator, and you can type in your zip code and how many miles you're willing to travel, and they will provide you with the contact information for a professional conservator who is a member of AIC and adheres to their code of ethics.
All right, and Frank is on the line from Dubuque. It sounds like, Frank, you have a word of warning for all of us.
Yes, well, thank you. I'm listening to the program, and an idea occurs to me that I've become aware that the number one problem to damage in basements is through the hose that goes to your washing machines burst through your laundry machines. So I watched this old house. One thing you can do is, maybe if a plumber can buy a device that will automatically shut off your washing machines, and then you have to turn them on each time because people forget to turn off the hoses. But I think that's going to cost you about $250, $300. So the other option is just replace your hoses, which I need to do myself. I've had them for 10 years, and I need to do that.
All right. Well, Frank, thanks a lot for the warning. But, you know, I think that a lot of these mini disasters do come from places that we would never think of. A faucet that breaks and you don't know where the water shutoff valve is. Christina, you must hear a lot of stories like that.
Yes, we do hear a lot of stories like that. You should be aware of how your house works, where to turn off the electricity, where to turn off the gas in case of a gas leak, where to turn off the water main to the house. Those are all very important things that you should do, and you should do it today. Find out today where all of that stuff is rather than waiting, oh, well, next week maybe. So, again, proactive. Decide now what you want to preserve and how you're going to go about preserving it.
Well, and Nancy, you were mentioning during the break that you think people should have a to-go bag with a few really important documents, and these aren't even necessarily the historic ones that we're talking about, or the memory-type items that we're talking about. What do you think we need to have ready to leave?
Right. We found this out the hard way in 2008, that you really need your birth certificate, your passport, your marriage certificate, your abstract or deeds to your house. And then they always mention, make sure you have your medications. And if you have a pet, then you should have the vet records. Now, most of the time we can always get to these, but in 2008 we couldn't. And filling out paperwork and getting prescriptions and all that became very difficult. So those should be in your... Plus the phone numbers that I mentioned.
Right.
You shouldn't assume that your phone is, any of your phones are going to work. Hopefully one will.
Well, and of course, during the floods of 2008, the courthouse flooded in Iowa City, right? Or no, not in, Cedar Rapids. And there were banks.
The banks flooded.
So safe deposit boxes suddenly weren't necessarily safe either.
Correct. So you should at least have all the copies of all these things with you so that you've got your numbers and all of that.
Things that, that you hate to have to think about. And we were talking earlier about those fireproof boxes, and the question came up, are they floodproof? Do we know?
So, I'm a skeptic. So if so, you know, I always, if I get something that's supposed to be waterproof, I pour water over it to make sure. If I print out a digital photograph on, you know, at home on photograph paper, I throw it in water to make sure that it's going to withstand water. Something in my scrapbook says it's water, it's color fast. I drip water on it to make sure it is.
Everything in your home has been Nancy tested and approved.
Well, no, I'm guilty as everyone else is.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Nancy Kraft, head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries, Christina Castell, curator of history and anthropology at Putnam Museum in Davenport, and Melissa Tadone, conservator at Iowa State University's library, and we're talking about historic preservation this hour. If you have questions about artifacts in your own home, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about historic preservation. Coming up on Friday, experts from around the state will meet in Mason City at Save Our Stuff 2013. It's put on by the Iowa Conservation and Preservation Consortium, the McNider Art Museum, and the Mason City Public Library. Of course, they probably didn't think that when you set up this conference that we'd be talking about floods again this year, but we have been focusing on flooding and historic preservation so far this hour. With me, Nancy Kraft, head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries, Christina Castell, curator of history and anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport, and Melissa Tidone, who's conservator at Iowa State University's library. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're also welcoming another guest to the conversation. Grace Linden is curator of history at the Sioux City Public Museum. Hi, Grace.
Hi there.
Thank you for being here. Welcome back to the show.
Okay, thanks.
And Grace, one of the things you're going to be talking about at this conference is preserving architectural drawings. And it strikes me that, that those aren't items that were really designed to be kept forever.
That is true. Architects had to have the plans on paper so that they could use them during construction. But what has been found over the years is that they need old plans to actually renovate buildings, and so people have been keeping them. And even if a building has been torn down, the architectural drawings are kept as a historic value for the community so they can see what type of buildings were there.
And how do you preserve something that wasn't really meant to be kept?
Well, that's tricky, too. But most of the architectural drawings that cultural institutions have are rolled up. And when you want to view them and you have to unroll them and hold them down, it's very, very difficult. And the preservation issues also arise with opening and unrolling these over and over. They start to crack. They're brittle because the paper is probably pretty dry. So what we do is a process called humidification, where we try to get a little moisture back into the paper, roll them out, put weights down on the paper, and then flatten them. But then the problem arises, where are you going to store them? Because you have very, very big drawings, sometimes 2 or 3 feet square. And so you need actual large storage units to store these in, but it is better for the drawings.
And it's funny that you talk about humidification because we were just talking about how humidity is the enemy of preservation. So how do you find a balance?
Well, the humidity that we put into these papers is very, very small. We don't actually dip these into water or anything. We put them in a humidification chamber just for a couple hours to get some moisture into that paper. Then we take it out really quickly. We put it on actually blotter paper or wool sheets because wool absorbs the moisture that is in the paper. And that at that time is when we put everything on top of it to flatten it out. So the water is dried out very quickly from the paper, so there's no permanent damage.
All right. And so where do you keep them for long term?
Well, actually, there's a lot of catalogs that people can go to find map cases, they're called. They're very large metal cases with drawers that open that fit architectural drawings, oversized photographs, maps, and they're flat, of course, and you can put many, many drawing sets in one case. But also, if you have a set of cabinets with nothing on top of them, you can lay them out flat there. There's even things that you can build with pallets and so forth for large, flat things. You just have to be a little inventive, I guess.
All right. I want to return to a subject that we were talking about earlier, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions, whether you're trying to preserve something that wasn't meant to be preserved or or you're trying to preserve something that that was meant to be preserved, but we just didn't have the knowledge when it was put together. We'll take your questions at 866-780-9100. And that beaded prayer that we were talking about earlier, I want to return to that because Jackie sent us another email to clarify what it is. She says, the words of the prayer are made with small glass beads that she assumes are strung on thread. They're attached to a pierced paper that's much like a backing for needlework, but this is paper. The paper is the background and not completely covered with beads. Only the lettering is beaded. And again, she says that paper and backing were not acid-free. The paper's darkened and deteriorating, and she's afraid to move it from its current frame because it looks so fragile. So now that we know what it is, Melissa, do you have any words of wisdom?
Absolutely. First of all, I'm very glad to hear that she has not removed it from its frame yet. I definitely recommend when someone has an item that they suspect is damaged or fragile like that, that they take that item to a conservator and let the conservator remove it from the frame. A professional conservator will know how to do that safely. I don't think Jackie should give up. It sounds like something that certainly could be addressed. It's possible that the paper could be lined to give it extra support, or that there might be some other measures that a conservator could take. And it's always worth talking to a conservator anyway, because you don't have to move forward with the actual treatment work. If you decide it's too expensive or it's not worth it for you for whatever reason, that's fine. But most conservators are willing to at least have that initial conversation with you.
All right. Here's a question. And Christina, I think you'd be the best one to respond to this. How can I best store vintage clothing, wool, linen, mixed cotton, in a cedar chest, in plastic boxes? I think a lot of us worry about the integrity of textiles when we store them.
That's true. First of all, a lot of us have a tendency to store clothes in the bags that they come back in from the dry cleaners. Don't do that. That's, again, a polyvinyl chloride plastic, and it can off-gas the chloride gas, chlorine gas, and that's damaging for the textiles themselves. So what you want to do is, if your textile, if your garment is strong enough to hang on a hanger, put it on a padded hanger so that you're not getting creases on the shoulders, and hang it in your closet. Textiles like to be where we are. We can keep track of them then, too, because the major pest for clothing is the clothes moth, and you have to see it to be able to prevent it from destroying your textiles, and the best place to see it is where you live. So textiles like to live on the main floor. They don't like to be folded because they tend to break down on the fold lines. So if you have quilts, roll them instead of folding them, or if you must fold them for storage sake, then have a plan to refold them every 6 months or so on a different fold line so that you're not pressing those folds into the fabrics.
Well, a lot of people want to preserve wedding dresses in particular, and you have a choice of getting them in a box or hanging. What do you recommend?
I recommend putting them in your own box.
Okay.
I remember one woman told me that she had her wedding dress put in a box right after her, cleaned and put in a box right after her wedding. 20 years later, she went to open it up to wear it for a fashion show, as sometimes happens, and the dress had never been cleaned. The armpit stains were completely yellowed in and deteriorating the fabric. So I would recommend that you do it yourself.
Right, and what kind of box?
An acid-free box that you can get through a number of archival supply stores. It's worth it to go ahead and invest in a good quality acid-free box and acid-free tissue for a wedding dress.
All right, and a lot of people want, of course, cedar chests are the time-tested tool for storing clothing and quilts and that kind of thing. How do you feel about cedar chests?
Not very good. Wood is highly acetic.
Okay.
So if you must put something in a cedar chest, make sure that it's not touching the wood. Line the cedar chest with fabric, aluminum foil, anything that's going to keep that acid away from the textiles that are in it.
Okay, we have a lot of people with questions, so let's get to the phones. Judy is on the line. Hi, Judy.
Oh, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have specific questions around the retention of digital images. So as I'm going through and preserving copies of these documents in electronic form, my understanding is that some CDs, for example, only retain that image for a number, like maybe 5 years. Some are a little longer. I don't know how to tell the difference. As the technology is changing so rapidly, how do we keep those digital copies from deteriorating? And is there a location I can go to online and get some of that information?
All right, Nancy?
Well, she's hit it on the head. It's a continually changing environment. We used to recommend CDs, but she just identified a problem there. You don't know how long it's going to last. What we tend to say is to be redundant. So you can put them on CDs, but also get one of those external hard drives. The other thing, so you've got them in two different places. It's still best if you've got some things that you really, really want to keep to get them printed out. And you can subscribe to the cloud. I think Amazon has that you can.
There are a lot of different companies
that you can do
that. Cloud storage online.
Right. The thing I would strongly recommend is to figure out how you're going to retrieve them. So make sure you have a good foldering system so that you can keep track of. And that's where I fall down.
All right. And someone else had a question about digital photographs. I've printed many color photos from my HP DeskJet printer using their inks and highest quality printer paper. They've not faded even after being out in light for 8 years. What do you think about the long-term life expectancy? And how would you make prints of the most precious family photos to have them available in 100 years? That's from Ellen in Decorah.
And again, make sure that you're doing just as he is that you are using the printer and the ink and the paper that's recommended for that. They're not interchangeable. And then just what I do when I make the first print, when I get a new setup, I take one photo and cover it half up and tape it against a window. And I also throw copies in the water. And if they pass those tests, they also have tests you can look online.
Okay.
And they'll give you stability and UV and all those kinds of information.
All right. Mary's up next from Altoona. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I had a question on those kind of 1980s era photo albums with the plastic layered over the sticky page. And you said to take them off, and earlier it was said to take those off, and I've been trying to do that, but some of them are really kind of almost melted on and stuck. Do you have any advice as to how to remove those?
Melissa?
I do. There is a tool. It's one of the conservator's favorite tools called a micro spatula.
Microspatula,
yeah.
Okay.
You can find them online easily. You can also often find them at craft and hobby stores. And it can be helpful, you know, find an edge of the photograph where there's maybe a little bit of a gap, and you
right.
can start to slip that spatula under there. And then just, it takes patience. You go slowly and carefully moving that microspatula in a sort of arc under the photo to carefully pry it up. Another thing that you can try that's very low-tech but often works quite well is to use unflavored waxed dental floss. And you can sort of slip it under a corner of the photo and then carefully, with a sort of back-and-forth sawing motion, sort of, work it slowly across under the photograph to help
floss
pop it
your
off.
Photos out.
That's right.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for your call and good luck with that. And Mark is on the line from Ames. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, everyone. My question is about foxing on an old colorized photograph from the 1870s. It is by no means bad, but the one spot of foxing I have happens to be on the face. I don't think this is something I want to try to attempt myself. What's your suggestions?
And what is foxing first, Nancy?
That's it's usually a brownish-red spot.
Okay.
Yes.
And I don't know if Melissa wants to take this.
Sure. Well, the problem with foxing is no one can quite agree what causes it. Some people think that it's iron particles mm-hmm. in the paper, maybe from the water in the paper okay. making process. Some people think it might be a sort of mold caused residue. And unfortunately, there's not really much that can be done to take it out. Sometimes various forms of bleaching helps. That's not something I recommend that anyone tries at home.
No,
that's something only a professional should attempt. And for something like this, like a colorized photograph, that's really tough.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to look into consulting a professional conservator. And if you really want that taken care of, you might have to sort of get into the realm of more restoration
okay.
rather than simply conservation and maybe have that in painted or something like that.
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And unfortunately, we're out of time. And Melissa, can you just remind us again? I think a lot of people have questions about conserving their things. Where do you need to look for information if you're looking for someone who can help you with conservation?
I highly recommend the American Institute for Conservation of Historic and Artistic Works. And if you plug in that long phrase into Google, their website will pop up. They have a Find a Conservator database on their website, and they're also very responsive if you contact them, and they can direct you to various other organizations and institutions as well as conservators in private practice.
All right. Melissa Tadone, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Tadone, conservator at Iowa State University Library. Grace Linden, thank you.
Thank you.
Grace Linden, curator of history at the Sioux City Public Museum. Christina Kestell, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Christina Kestell, curator of history and anthropology at the Putnam Museum in Davenport. And Nancy Kraft, thank you.
Welcome.
Nancy Kraft is head of preservation at the University of Iowa Libraries. We're talking about historic preservation this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, with technical support today from Jason Burns. And we've been talking about preserving things that may have been damaged by the flood. We're going to talk more about flooding today at noon with Ben Kiefer on River to River. Ben, what's your plan?
Indeed we are. We're all grateful for the break from the steady diet that we've had of the heavy storms that over the weekend. We have had some rivers and streams fall in level over the weekend. So we're asking, is the worst of this spring flooding over? Officials are telling us to be cautious. We'll find out about details and hear from some of the communities that have been affected by this spring flooding coming up at noon, Charity.
All right, Ben. Thank you very much. And you can email us anytime, talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on this show, the 8035 play-in from IPR Studio 1.